My name is Alma Carrillo, and I'm interviewing Arnulfo Pompa. Today is January 12, 2008, and this is for the Bracero History Project. Thank you so much, Mr. Arnulfo, for being here today.
You're welcome.
Can you please share where and when were you born?
I was born August 14, 1962. I was born here in Arizona in El Mirage, a little town just a little bit south, northwest of here.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about your family, about you growing up?
Sure. There are six of us. My dad came over as a bracero in 1947, I believe. I might be off by a year or two, but I'm the youngest of the six. And, of course, being the youngest, I was always the protected child with my parents. But the one thing I do remember growing up, I don't remember the early years, obviously, when he came over, because my sisters and brothers are much older than I am, and they probably have those stories. But one of the common threads, and this is one of the things I was going to mention to you earlier, one of the common threads of all the friends that I had made in the labor camps growing up, and my memories probably start around 3 or 4 years old, because I do remember, you know, we used to have to go out to the fields and pick onions and do that kind of thing. And that was the only life that I knew. And one of the common threads that I remember just from all my friends that we grew up all in the camps, we were all having fun. We didn't know any better. We thought, this is a great life. You know, you get up in the morning, your mom has breakfast, tortillas, beans, whatever, and you go out and play and do your thing with your friends and your buddies in the neighborhood. And I call it a neighborhood, but I don't know if you have an experience with a labor camp, but it literally was that. It was two or three apartments, duplexes put together, you know, two or three rows, 4 or 5 rows deep, and there's probably 100 families living in those labor camps. This was probably 1964 when I started getting, 65 when I started getting some of those memories, and that's the time when I remember mostly about what my dad was like. He knew he was struggling. Now, as I got older, now that I know, looking back, but the thing that I cherished about him so much was that he made it so seamless. It was, he never let on about how bad we were doing, and he would not let his family suffer. There was times there where I wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 days, obviously, because he was working for Goodyear Farms when I was born, and Goodyear Farms actually created this whole West Valley. That's part of that historical society that we were talking about earlier. And working with Goodyear Farms, there was points in times where I wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 days, because I think today they call them double shifts. Mm-hmm. But back then they had him working 18-hour days, you know, from 6 a.m. probably till 10 o'clock at night out in the fields, you know, taking care of the water, taking care of the irrigation was part of his deal. But, you know, this was when I was 4 or 5 years old, and I don't remember a whole lot of him back then, but then I started realizing I'm not seeing him because of that. Mm-hmm. My mother was there to take care of us in the morning when we were going to school. She also had to work out in the fields to make a living for ourselves. So the point in time when I started bringing all these memories together as I got older, you know, things start triggering. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, the common thread is just the fun that I had growing up in those labor camps. Now, as I grew a little bit older, you know, I started going to school at you know, 5 years old, going into kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Being part of Litchfield Park, and I'm not sure how much history or how much knowledge you have of that area. Back then, in the early 1960s, Litchfield Park was the richest town in Arizona, in my mind. You know, you had the doctors and the lawyers and everybody living there. So what happened was, you know, we have Litchfield Park here where, it still exists today. It's a beautiful city. You have the Wigwam Resort, which is a 5-star resort. Everything there was owned by Goodyear Farms, and that's who my dad worked for. So our labor camps, there was 5 of them that I can remember. We lived in one called Camp 53. Mm-hmm. And this was probably, I don't know, 2 miles west of Litchfield Park. So what happened is these kids of the farm laborers, they had to go to school somewhere, right?
Yes.
So we all got registered, and we all went to Litchfield Park Elementary School. So that's where we started. I started there when I was 5 years old, but I think when I was in first or second grade, you know, 6, 7 years old, that's when I started realizing how poor we really were. I would go to school, and my mother always took care of us as far as, you know, clean clothes. Mm-hmm. You always had, you know, clean pair of jeans, slacks, whatever. But seeing the way some of these other kids grew up in Litchfield Park, you know, I made friends very easily, as we all did. I remember in first grade, a friend of mine, he had just moved from another state. His dad was a doctor, Greg Brandenburg. He invited me over to spend the night at his house. I said, yeah, sure. So I asked he goes, why don't you give me your telephone number so I can call you? And I said, well, you know, we don't have a phone. Let me just ask my parents. Okay. So the next day I asked my dad, can I spend the night Friday night? You can pick me up Saturday. Yeah, sure. So we walked home from school that evening because I had permission, and you know, it was probably a 10-minute walk from school to his house. Mm-hmm. And when I got into his house, I'm like, oh my God, is this how people are really living? That's when it triggered. I'm like, and it wasn't envy. It was more or less like, there's another world out there that I don't know about. And you know, I'm in first grade. I'm 6 years old. So Greg was my best friend probably from first grade all the way through seventh or eighth grade, and we still kept in touch through high school. He moved out of state, but he is one of the biggest memories that I have growing up because he taught me the other side. And he would, I don't think he did it, and I always asked my other brother, Humberto, I said, do you think Greg is giving me this bicycle because he feels sorry for me? And he goes, no, don't think about it that way. I think he's just being a good friend of yours. And, you know, he would give me things. His mom would give me clothes, and another time I spent the night there with them, it was Sunday, Saturday through Sunday. So Sunday they drove me home, and I was begging them, no, my dad will come pick me up, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, don't worry about it, Arnulfo, we'll take you home. So I get in this brand new Cadillac, right? They're driving me home, and they go, okay, well, just give us directions on how to get to your house. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I going to get through this one? So sure enough, they're driving me home down Indian School Road, which is right here. They're taking me home, and we get to the labor camp, and I go, yeah, you got to turn left here. And as soon as you turn into those labor camps, they're dirt roads, and they're just little, apartments that are so small, just two-bedroom apartments for 8 people. I mean, that doesn't work. So, you know, they drove me in there. I'm in the back seat just, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do here? And there's kids out there playing basketball in the dirt with the made, it wasn't even a manufactured hoop. It was just a rim on a post. Mm-hmm. Oh, Arnulfo, do you play basketball with these boys? And I said, yeah, occasionally I'll come over here and play. So they're driving me home. Their car's getting full of dust because mm-hmm. it's all dirt out there. And I was so embarrassed. They got off, and they knocked on the door. Well, I walked in, and I said, well, you guys don't need to come in. I'm good now. And I was really embarrassed because they were going to meet my folks mm-hmm. who didn't speak a word of English. My dad was working, I think, that day, but my mother came out. She introduced herself with the parents, and to this day, my mindset changed a few years ago. But there was a point in time where that was probably the most embarrassing moment in my life. As I got older, I started thinking, you know what? They probably didn't even care, just like I wouldn't today. You know, we're all doing well. If I was running in the same situation, I had to drive a kid home, I wouldn't care. But I didn't know any better back then. So that was a huge experience. I mean, I'm only 6 years old. So at that time, I started thinking, okay, maybe there's other things out there that I need to concern myself with. And one of the things that my father always told us is that you have to have an education. He came to this country without being able to read or write even Spanish. He didn't even have an education in Mexico.
He didn't go to school at all?
He didn't go to school at all in Mexico. I think he probably finished like 2 or 3 years.
What did he do in Mexico?
He was, I think he was more of a laborer down there as well. You know, he had 6 or 7 brothers and like 3 sisters. They were a huge family. But I think from the onset, because they were poor down there as well, he had to work. I mean, he was probably working since he was 7 or 8 years old as well.
Where is he from?
He is from Los Mochis, and I think that's in Sinaloa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was born there.
And your mom is from there as well?
My mother was born in Chihuahua, Mexico, and that's my dad moved down there at some point in time in his life, and that's how they met. And he ended up bringing her back up here, I don't know, probably 1952, I think.
So he was working as a bracero for how long?
I think he only worked as a bracero, and I could be a little off on these dates, but I think he came over 1947, and I think he only worked through 1956, probably 8 or 9 years. Because at that time, He was coming back and forth from Mexico because that was the, I guess they had provided him that luxury to go back mm-hmm. and back and forth. So when he met my mother, he went back, married her, and then he had the two older children, Elio that Maida interviewed, and then Delia. And then they decided that, you know, he decided to bring them back mm-hmm. here. So applied for the paperwork, whatever. He came, became a legal resident. My mother became a legal resident. They came through El Paso, I think. So they lived in Texas for a couple of years. And that's when my other brother was born, Humberto.
So when he was working as a bracero, was he also working at Goodyear?
No, no. See, I was born way after the fact of the bracero impact. He was a bracero from 47 to 56, I believe. He started working at Goodyear Farms, I think it was like 59, mm-hmm. 58 or 59. But as he was working for Goodyear, I mean, that's a whole other story. When he was working for Goodyear Farms, it was a place that he thought, obviously, you know, it was work, it was labor, it was working out in the fields, but the company was so huge that his friends at the time were telling him, you know, this is a great company to stay with, you'll get a retirement, this and that never happened. I mean, 10 years ago, I mean, he was still trying to get some money out of Goodyear Farms because they didn't even, as far as I understood, they didn't even put together any retirement package for any of their employees. And he was laid off at the time, and I think that was their excuse to say, sorry, you don't get anything. So after he was laid off in the late 60s, early 70s, he kind of roamed around different farms.
So when you were little, you were living, you said, at Goodyear?
We were living in it was called Litchfield Park. The whole area was called Litchfield Park, but it was a labor camp. It was they called it 1950 or Camp 53. There was Camp 53, Camp 54, and Camp 52. And it was funny that all of us ended up, because they were all so close proximity-wise, we all ended up going to Litchfield Elementary School. And, you know, you had your 80% rich kids that came from Litchfield Park, and then we had the other, you know, 15, 20% labor family. And that's not a bad thing. Integration is always really good, but I think there was a culture shock for a lot of people, especially on the other side of the fence. But we all got integrated very well, and I think we did, for the most part, as far as I can speak for my own family and for one other family that I know, that we all did very well growing up in that area.
How did your parents speak English?
None at all. My dad, we grew up speaking Spanish, mm-hmm. obviously, and first day of kindergarten, I should have brought that picture. I mean, I have tears in my eyes because they took a picture the first day of school. Uh-huh. Tears in my eyes. I have the pucheros going on because I didn't know a word of English. None of us did, and I didn't know English until I got into school. But I think looking back, that was probably the best way to do it. English was very easy for all of us to pick up, and lo and behold, by second grade, I was at the top of my class practically. You know, there was one other kid that was just above me, just mm-hmm. all these years, and it's like I was trying
There's
to catch up.
Somebody.
There was always him. He was trying to catch, and Jeffrey Ritchie, that was his name. It was interesting growing up there. And then,
so how was life living at that camp, at that labor camp?
I think with the early years that I'm telling you about, those were the fun years. You know, and by that I mean by my age, I was born in 62, so by 67, 68, I was still very little, very young. I was still having fun working there or living there. And as I got older, there was a necessity for the rest of the family to start working, mm-hmm. to support the family. And I tell my kids this because they need to know. We used to come home from school, and I think I started probably when I was in sixth grade. I'm sorry, when I was 6 or 7 years old. When we were coming home from school, we'd come home to what they called tardeadas. You get home, you pack a meal, bring bean burritos or whatever, and then you go out and work in the fields after school from 4 to whatever, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. And I remember the actual farmers would actually put big floodlights out there so that these families could go out there and pick onions. I said, okay. So that piece of it started grinding on me after a while, and I think, going to school and smelling like onions and, you know, getting made fun of sometimes because I smelled like onions. You couldn't get the smell out of you. And that was what I remember growing up mostly as far as working is concerned. And then as we got older, it was you know, my dad had the idea of like being a contratista, you know, going out and hiring folks like the middleman to go out and work in the fields, in the cotton fields, so that he would get a little bit of a commission, I guess. You know, back then they were paying $1.20 an hour, I believe, and, you know, he'd pay these workers $1.10 an hour, and he'd make 10 cents for every head that he would bring in, kind of thing. But even then, you know, that's all that he knew how to do. Mm-hmm. And although he instilled education in us, it was really difficult for the fact that, you know, as I got older, now that I realized that I could have worked somewhere else. You know, I could have worked like at a McDonald's or, you know, at a grocery store or something. But, you know, as well as I did in school, it never dawned on me that I could go and apply somewhere else.
Until what age did you work in the
fields? Oh, I worked in the fields till I was a sophomore in high school. In the summers, as soon as school was over in May, boom, we were there. I was there anyway. Me and my older brother Bert, because he was living at home at the time, Ramiro and everybody else, they had already gotten other jobs, but I didn't know that I could apply anywhere else. I mean, I was old enough, but it was just that mindset.
How was it that you were able to work so young? Was this anybody checking?
No. Back then, and I don't know the laws, but I know that as the labor families, the ones that really meshed and became really close, I think we're still friends with some of them, and most of them are still alive as far as the parents are concerned, but we would all go to the fields together. And it wasn't the fact that, you know, the mom and dad and the two oldest kids would go and somebody would stay home and babysit the little ones. No, they would drag us all. And sometimes it was fun. You know, we'd go out there, and I remember when I was 5 or 6 years old, my dad had a little bucket for me to fill up with onions. And I'm sitting there clipping and doing my own thing. And for me, it was fun, you know, when I was little. And no, they didn't have anybody checking. You know, I remember that being out in the fields, you could have, you could make it a whole, like a picnic type of thing, because you'd work from 5 in the morning, pick onions till like 1 or 2, and then you'd go home and use that day's earnings to go buy some food and then go home and eat. And basically, that's what it was for.
And did you have any, like, immigration coming around?
Yes, there were, but we had nothing to worry about.
But were there other workers there that didn't have documentation?
Not that I recall. There was probably a few, but back then I shouldn't say it wasn't like it is today, but because I don't know what the field workers are doing or the laborers are doing today, but back then it was just assumed that everybody was legal. It's kind of a weird thought, but you know, I remember seeing the migra out there every once in a while, but they'd nab maybe one or two people out of, you know, 100 that were out there working, and that to me is not a whole lot. I'm sorry. I remember seeing these guys coming in their green suits and their white vans, but it really was never a threat. The one story I do have is with Elio, and he's going to hate this, but we were out working in the cotton fields, and this was probably when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and we were out in Rainbow Valley working in the cotton fields, and here comes the migra, right? Mm-hmm. And we're out there chopping weeds. And my dad, he was the biggest jokester in the world, and Elio was born in Mexico. And the migra comes up the rows, you know, you see these guys in these uniforms, they come up, and, ¿De dónde eres? De México. ¿Y tus papeles? So my dad would take his wallet out and go, here's my green card. Mm-hmm. And with us kids, you know, we were bilingual, but they would ask us, where are you from? I was born here in Arizona, so they would say, okay, you're fine. And my dad, he scared the heck out of Elio, goes, ¿Tienes tus papeles? No, ¿por qué? Pues ahí viene la migra, te van a llevar a México, cabrón, si no tienes tus papeles. And he started bawling. So the migra comes up to him and they go, oye, muchacho, ¿y tus papeles? Los tiene mi mamá en la casa. Yo no los tengo aquí. And he was just bawling. He, you know, he's 5 or 6 years older than me, so he's 13 years old. I mean, he's scared because he really thought that they were going to take him. And they're like, oh, you're fine. Don't worry about it. So, you know, that was that experience. And it was hilarious. And we would always talk about that, even, you know, till my dad passed away a few years ago.
And can you describe a little bit about the labor camps? How do they look like?
You know, I think Ramiro did bring maybe one picture, but it was essentially duplexes. There were like three little apartments, together, and then you'd have a little gap, and then you'd have three more. But there was one, two, three. There was like four or five rows of these duplexes, and they would go all the way across. The camp was split in half, and then on the other side of the dirt road there was houses. And if you did well with the company, mm-hmm. from my understanding, you'd be able to move into those houses. So there was even division within the camp. You know, here are the Pompas living on one corner over here in a little two-bedroom apartment. They weren't even bedrooms. They didn't even have doors, but two little bedroom apartment with, you know, eight people living there. And that, you have the Lopezes living on the other side because their dad was a foreman at Goodyear Farms. Mm-hmm. So he was able to get a house. And the houses back then, you'd walk in them and, wow, you know, kind of, I wish I lived on this side of the camp. But it was interesting. It was... the families that all lived there, there was, I would say probably 80% of them worked at Goodyear Farm. I don't know how the other families were able to live there, but I think these were owned, I know they were owned by Goodyear Farms. So everybody had to work for Goodyear. One member of the family at least had to work there.
How about, were there more men than women working there?
No. Well, I would say if probably 2-to-1 ratio, my mother has some great pictures of her and her friends working out there too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was one picture that I do recall, and it's at her house right now. That Tina Ayala used to come and pick her up every day in the Jeep, you know. And this was like 4:30 or 5 in the morning, she would have all our breakfast done and all our clothes was laid out for school, and she would take off to work with Tina Ayala. And there was one picture that she shared with us that they took after work. And, you know, my mother was probably 45, 48 years old, and they have the big Coors beer cans like this, drinking after work, and they're sitting there with their, you know, with their work clothes, and mm-hmm. They decided to get drunk that day. And there's probably four, maybe five women in that particular group that were always hanging around together. I do remember... one thing about Goodyear Farms, it was almost slave labor, you know, for the people that were working there. My dad didn't get, there wasn't minimum wages back then, so my dad didn't get paid a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. There was a store there called Abraham's, and it was in Litchfield Park, and it was, again, this was all owned by Goodyear Farms. And that was the only grocery store that we knew of. So it was, you know, 2 or 3 miles from our house. We would drive up there and shop for groceries. The arrangement that they had was, you were allowed, as long as you worked at Goodyear Farms, you were allowed to charge your food if you didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. So I remember, you know, it was always trying to catch up. My dad and mom could never do it. It was, you know, there were always a paycheck behind because there was 6 kids that they had to feed. Yes. And we'd get to the store and, you know, I remember my dad and mom buying food. It was probably, it was like a $48 bill or something like that. So, you can, you know, go ahead and charge it. Here's my account. I don't have any money. So they would automatically deduct it out of your paycheck. So I remember the next paycheck, he'd get paid every 15 days. I think the paycheck was probably $2. So we're expected to survive from, you know, from point A, where we don't have any money for another 15 days. So that's why my mom had to go out and work in the fields as well. I mean, she was a stay-at-home mom for a little bit that I remember, but for the most part, she was gone during the day as well, because we were in school anyway.
What happened with the money that you and your brothers and sisters made?
There was a little rule with my father. Everything came back to him, mm-hmm. because we had to support, you know, the mortgage payment and the rent or food and clothes and all of that stuff. So everything came back to him. If we worked on Saturdays, whatever we made on Saturdays, we went ahead and kept. As the kids got older, as Elio and Rosa and Bert got older, they were able to keep some of their wages through for the week. I'm guessing here maybe a day or two's worth of wages, and that was probably $8 or $9 a day.
Were you able to work while going to school?
Oh, this was in the summer.
In the summer.
In the summer. But during the school, we always, probably 80% of the school year, we probably ended up working anyway. You know, you'd get out of school at 4, and back then we used to go to school till 4 o'clock, I think, we used to get out. The bus used to take us home. Vámonos a las tardeadas. He'd wait. He'd be there waiting for us. And it's like, man, not again, please. I don't want to go. At the same time, we had to do all our homework. So it was an interesting experience. But the Goodyear Farms thing, I think still, I think it was still a lot of bad blood there, even when my dad passed away, because they didn't treat him nor a lot of other people right. And we, you know, there was a class action lawsuit, if I'm not mistaken, to try to get some of that retirement money that they were supposed to have been promised as well.
So did your father, when did he retire? When did he stop working?
Completely, you mean? That was by no choice of him. I remember I was at our house. We had since then moved from the camp to another little neighborhood. He and Elio and my older sister and my other brother, they were out working in the fields that summer. And I remember they came home early. And I think I was like 10 or 11 years old. I was there helping my mom at the house. And they came home early, and I looked down and said, Mom, ¿por qué? Ya llegaron, mira que temprano. It was like 10 o'clock. And Elio runs in and goes, my dad's really, really sick. And I'm like, wow, shoot, what's going on? So we went out there, and it took all of us to try to bring him in. He ended up having rheumatoid arthritis, and he never knew about this, never knew anything, but he got an attack out in the field, and he couldn't even walk. And it completely crippled him. From that moment, it was just like, you know, the pain was so hard. So those were hard times, because he was at least working for Anderson Farms, I think is what it was back then. And he ended up with that rheumatoid arthritis. He finally, it took forever, he finally got a doctor's notice to say, yeah, you can't work anymore because, you know, you're disabled, basically, is what he was labeled. But I remember that was a lean, probably 2 or 3 years as well. I mean, leaner than what we were used to. There was no income coming in. You know, my mom and dad were very proud of not going and applying for welfare, but we finally had to. But that paperwork takes forever. And we're talking probably 1971, I think. And one time, my other sister, Rosa, was not here. Her and I and my father and my mother, and my dad wasn't feeling well at all. I remember getting up one time, having to go to to pick onions, and it was the green onions, the ones that you would wrap with a rubber band. And it was in the middle of winter. We had to go do that on a Saturday just to make enough money to go buy a dozen eggs and some tortillas. And that's etched in my mind. It's like, man, there's something, you know, we need to figure something out here. So again, I mean, our fallback, all of us, was education. I mean, that was the only way that I knew of to get. And again, I think all of these experiences is build your character and make you who you are going forward in life. But it was rough. I mean, there was times when, you know, I had holes in my tennis shoes, and that's all I had. And I tell my mom, well, pues mijo, no tenemos, you know, what are we going to do? He goes, ve a la enfermera, la escuela, a ver qué te dan. You know, I'd go to the Mrs. Yanes. She was a Mexicana. She was always treating us just a little bit better. Hi, Mrs. Yanes. My mom sent me in here to see if you have any extra jackets or any tennis shoes, especially. And she goes, yeah, come on back. See, and it was lost and found. So we'd go through the box of lost and found. Yeah, these fit. Can I have them? Yeah. Oh, man, I was all happy. Brand new or used pair of shoes, but for me, they were new. There was another time when the Litchfield Park the elementary school was having a Christmas play, Christmas pageant, and we didn't have a tree that year at the house, and we never really had any tree or Christmas, but my sister Rosa, she got a bright idea. She's like, you know what? This is the last day of school before we go on Christmas break. I'm going to go see what they're going to go do with that tree. So she asked one of the teachers, I don't know if it was a principal or something, what are you guys going to do with this tree? Oh, we're going to throw it away because we're going to be closed down for a week or two. Can we have it? Yeah, you guys can come pick it up. So we went home. She was all excited, got my dad, got in his old pickup, went back to school, and we picked it up, took it back and decorated it. That was really cool. I mean, that my sister had thought about doing that for the rest of the family, and it was really neat. And I think that was the same year where somehow or other they figured out a way to go shopping and provide for us at least something real minimum. Mm-hmm. My brother got an Etch-a-Sketch that year. I think I got a pair of socks, and my brother got a deck of cards. You know, little things like that, but it was at least something, because we weren't used to any of that stuff. But, you know, I don't mean to drag on to how, but that's the way, that was reality.
No, it's part of life.
That was just the way it was. I mean, we did have a blast. We did have fun all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was reality setting in saying, wow, you know, this is going to be our lives, and we're going to have to figure out a way to get through the struggle.
Yeah. So you were saying that you used to have a lot of fun when you were little, including even as you were helping your parents with the onions. What else did you do for fun with your siblings or with your friends?
Ramiro, the Colorado that you just met a little bit ago, he and I were only 2 years apart. So he and I grew up basically together. And one of the things that I do remember, because the roads that were out there, we didn't have like landscaping or anything. It was just dirt. So we would go out and grab a couple of garden hoses, you know, the asadones, and we make little trails like this, and we'd take rocks and make our own little, like, forts and stuff, and we'd have a little Tonka toy, and that was it. We could be out there for hours playing with these toys, and then, you know, we'd have our other friends, Luis, Enriquez, he was another guy, Arthur Enriquez, they were cousins, and they lived just right around the bend, right around the corner from the camp. I mean, they were in the camp, but they lived right around on the other side. They used to come over, and they had bikes, and we used to swap, and I used to ride on the handlebars. And we used to, well, it was fun back then. It was all open area out here. Mm-hmm. We used to just hop on those bikes and just cruise down the dirt roads as far as you could go, cotton fields everywhere. And to us, it was like being Tom Sawyer. You know, we'd be out there, you know, just out in the fields messing around, and when it was time to come home and eat, we'd come home. But that was it. I mean, we would run around, we'd play kick the can a lot. I don't know if you've heard that game.
No.
It's kind of like baseball. You literally get a tin can and you put it out there in the field or in the middle of the road, and you kick it. And kick it as far as you can, and then you just try to run bases. That was kick the can. And have you ever seen the movie, it's slipping my mind right now. A little baseball movie with kids.
There's several, let me think.
My kids know it well, but we actually started that. I feel like we started that whole deal because we lived on a last row of houses, and back here was just an empty dirt. There was nothing there. Sandlot. You've heard that movie.
Oh, yes. I was going to say that movie.
Sandlot. Mm-hmm. And every day, the other kids that Maida was making fun of was Tonke, Titi, Toldillo, and Toldilla, all of that family. They were great baseball players. Awesome. Uh-huh. I mean, these guys, back then when I think about it, I'm like, wow, if these guys would have gone to college and maybe tried out for baseball, I bet you one of them would have made it. But in the summers when we weren't working or on a Saturday or Sunday, we'd go out there and they'd lay out the bases and we'd be out there playing baseball. And that was one of the big things. It almost turned into like a tournament, practically, mm-hmm. because there were so many kids in that neighborhood that, yeah, we'd all gather there in the sand lot.
Did you ever play with any of the adults?
No, I do remember. I used to hang around a lot with my dad. My dad and I were like this when I was little, and no matter where he went, Dad, what do we eat? Sí, vente, vámonos. You know, I'd go with him. But he was always picking up one of his friends. He was always helping somebody in the neighborhood when I, you know, growing up in that labor camp, giving somebody a ride somewhere or doing those kinds of things. And a lot of his friends I got to know very well. But the adults, they were like in their own little clique. They didn't really, you know, it's like, you kids go out and play. We're going to do our thing here. And there was a lot of partying and drinking. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, the parents, they figured out a way when things were good. And I know I'm jumping back and forth from year to year, but when things were okay, I mean, they would go out and buy their beer, and they, meaning my parents and their parents, and they'd have little block parties, and they'd be out there drinking beer.
Tell me about those block parties. Did they have music?
Oh, yeah.
Was it live? Was it the radio?
Yeah, it was the radio. It was, you know, just really just keeping your door open, your front door open, and whoever had the phonograph, stereophonic radio, you blast that, because the houses were so close in proximity. I mean, the street was probably no wider than from here to that wall, so the next group of houses was right there.
It was really close.
So if you opened your door, they could hear your conversation, or you could hear their music, and that's really what it was. And it was interesting.
What kind of music were they listening to at that time?
My dad always liked I know there's a name to it. I think it's called Sonorense. Is that type of music? Do you know?
Sinaloense.
I don't know.
It's more like norteña.
It's a lot of the accordion music and stuff. And they would have that music blasting all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was, to me, in my mind, that was what was always fun. I remember, and this like it happened yesterday. I can still remember these memories. One time they were having that block party. We were washing the car. I don't know why we would wash it because there's dirt out there. But that was it was a Sunday. I know it was a Sunday. And my dad had this old grill. I don't even know where he got it from. But we had, for whatever reason, we had steaks that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were cooking out steaks. And I remember looking up and going, God, please don't let this day end. I didn't want it to end. You know, we started cooking out, and we were having so much fun. And you didn't want that day to end ever. And you just looked around, and my brothers and sisters are all playing around in the front yard. You got the other neighbors that are out there. So it was fun. It was Carlin. He was cooking steaks. I mean, that was a rare treat. And, you know, he probably went to Abraham's and charged them. He probably wanted to make sure that he had at least, you know, and not that we, and I'm not painting the picture that we were, I mean, we had beans and tortillas to eat. So at least there was something to eat. Mm-hmm. But that was a treat. It was something that we never had. It was pretty rare, actually.
And when you were hanging in the fields working, were there any like divisions between like the people who had families and the people who didn't have families?
Not that I recall. That was I don't think there was any single adults. Childless adults. Mm-hmm. I think everybody had families. I mean, I don't remember anybody not having any kids. Like I said, there's still probably a handful of men now that we keep in touch with, that we all grew up together in that area.
You still friends with them?
Mm-hmm. One in particular, he was our best friend. Well, he was a good friend from Camp 52, mm-hmm. And then we all got close in school and in high school and stuff. And yeah, as a matter of fact, he married my wife's cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What's his name? Eddie Valenzuela. Yeah, he would have been a good story, but his dad wasn't a bracero. His dad was a lot younger than my father, but he grew up in the labor camps. His dad worked for Goodyear Farms as well. See, because like I said earlier, I came way after the bracero program. But,
You were saying that education was like an answer for the hard work that you mm-hmm. were having at that time. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, I don't want to pat ourselves on the back, but all six of us are very, very bright, and nobody ever really instilled that in us until my dad at some point, I must have been 8 years old when he finally said, hey, you know, thanks for bringing home good grades and keep it up, that kind of thing. And I'm like, well, I'm going to get rewarded for bringing home decent grades. And you know, since that point, like second grade on through high school, I mean, I was making straight A's. It was my goal. It was like, I gotta do this. But I mean, you know, everybody, we're all very, very sharp. We all have different levels of education. Mm-hmm. But back then, and this was in the 60s again, and 70s, if you didn't have a college degree, it was real difficult to get a job. And, you know, my sister, unfortunately, fell upon hard times. She wasn't able to graduate, but, you know, I was the first and only child, really, to... Well, all of them went to college, but I was the only, first one to go and complete my BA mm-hmm. in accounting, of all things, because I wanted to get into the business world. But I think if you were to see my family, Ramiro's family, Rosa's, everybody's, Elio's, mm-hmm. you know, how successful we all have been. I mean, you know, material things really aren't... Yes, we all have nice houses. We all have driving nice cars. And as the old saying goes, you only live once. You know, why not? I think it's a reward. I look at it as a reward for myself. And I mean, I'm a tightwad just because of the way I grew up. I hoard my money, but at the same time, I want to have fun. And I tell my kids that every single day about, you know, you got to think about how things can go from, you know, good to bad mm-hmm. in the blink of an eye. So
right now, you're still working as an accountant?
No, I've been kind of back and forth. After high school, I decided to go to ASU, Arizona State University. And it took me a while. I was on a 6-year program because I was going part-time. Mm-hmm. But I got a job at Quest. Back then it was Mountain Bell, or it was AT&T back then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all the breakups and the mergers and all of that stuff, it's now Quest Communications. But I've been there for 25 years. Hopefully five more and I'll be able to get out of there. But it's all about the education. As soon as I graduated from college, I started applying for management positions. And as long as you do well in the interview, you're in. And it's been a progression for the last, you know, 15 years. And I'm doing very well there.
What did your father have to say about that?
It was amazing. I think one of the biggest things that my dad was humble, but at the same time, if some of his friends jabbed him about things, he would let them know. There was one family, the Enriquez's. I hope it's not too derogatory, but that family, they're the ones that lived in those houses that I was telling you about. You remember how there was a division. Yeah, there was a fancy houses over there, and they weren't that fancy, but that's the way we looked at it. That family, they were huge. There were like 14 of them. They were always, always thinking that, arrogance. That's really what it boiled down to. They were just thinking that they were always better than everybody else. And the father especially, he would always jab my dad. Yeah, you know, your kids aren't ever going to amount to anything, and, you know, they're going to be doing this. At least my kids are contratistas. You know, they have the company truck and from Goodyear Farms. They have the company truck, and they're working. And I know it hurt my dad, but we were still young. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when Elio became a fire chief and the spokesperson for City of Glendale Fire Department, Ramiro's a big honcho over at Bank of America. I'm doing very well at Quest Community. I mean, he would gloat on that. It's like, you know, I'm so proud of you guys. And he would tell us. He goes, instill that in your kids. Make sure that they do the right things in life and this and that. We weren't perfect by no stretch. I mean, you know, we all had our scrapes and bruises, and we all got in some trouble. But I had to write a paper in high school about who your hero was, and it was always, you know, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. I wrote a paper on my dad, and my English teacher said, are you, you know, this is a truly warming, from the heart paper. Did you really mean to write this? I mean, she actually questioned it. I said, yeah. I said, you know, we're not the richest people in the world, but if it had been any other family, and we did see this with some of the families, that the kids just strayed, and got into drugs, and they're in jail, and some of them are dead, and, you know, it was tough.
So how was it that your father inspired you?
It was one of the things that he always told us, and I remember this again like if it was yesterday, if an employer hires you and you're contracted to work 8 hours, go in there and give them 8 hours worth of honest work. That's all that he would ever ask. So give me 8 hours or whatever, 10 hours, whatever you're asked of, make sure you have that integrity, because the integrity part was huge. You know, never steal, never lie, never do anything bad to your employer. I mean, he did this even after working at Goodyear Farms. It's like, if you're going to go work somewhere, just go work. Because I think he worked around enough lazy people that it probably upset him enough to say, you know, this guy's not pulling his share or the work. And it was really that. It was just be honest, have a lot of integrity.
Did he ever talk of the pier that he worked at Sabracero?
He may have told me, but I'll be quite honest with you, I don't remember a whole lot. I just know that the bigger story I do remember is working in Northern California. There's a city there, a little town called Gilroy, I think, picking cherries or something like that. But he was bouncing. Before he was married to my mother, he bounced from California to Idaho. He even says he worked in Michigan, I think, or Wyoming. Wyoming was was a big one. But I never really got into depth in any of the, if he told me, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. The stories I do hear is from my sister and my other brother was at. It was, I think looking back now, my interpretation of what I hear is that it is pretty much legalized slavery is what happened. You know, you know the whole story. I mean, because you're the expert, but, you know, they're brought over here to work and for measly wages, and they're, I don't know what kind of labor camps they were living in, but I never heard the intricate details of what, you know, how he lived, but I know that they were taken advantage of.
So what does the word bracero mean to you?
Bracero, I think, he always told me, yo me vine de bracero. Like, okay. I just looked at it too clear. It was just, you know, America was in World War II, and there was a labor shortage, and that's really all I ever thought about, that word, being Bracero. So.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories. Is there anything you would like to add?
Just, like I said, I hope it doesn't come on too hard that it was rough, you know, because it was. But, you know, that's just the way it was. And there's really no painting a pretty picture about it. It was a hard life. It was fun. We had a lot of fun, like I said. But looking back at it, it was like, wow, you know, I survived that. My other brother and sister and the older kids, you know, when they first lived in Texas, they had to live in a bus. I didn't have to go through that experience. So for me, at least, it was an upgrade living in this the labor camp. But even some of the friends that I keep in touch with from Litchfield Park, some of those guys, the rich guys that I deemed back then rich, you know, they ended up in trouble and in jail and on drugs. And it happens in every aspect of society. It even happened in ours. But, again, I think it all goes back to my father. Like I said, the biggest thing I could relay to you is that he made it as seamless as possible to not show that, you know, this is not a bad life. He knew it was. He knew it was better than Mexico. But he knew that there was more to accomplish here that he never was able to do.
Did he ever tell you about his life in Mexico?
He mostly just funny stories, just the funny stories about him. He and his brother just getting in trouble a lot. I mean, he was. You couldn't. He wouldn't stop talking. You could, like I said, you could have had him in here for 8 hours. I'm the quiet of the bunch, but he could have been in here for 8 hours, and he was getting in trouble a lot.
What is the best story he shared with you?
It's pretty bad.
Go for it.
I think he was probably 14 years old, mm-hmm. And this was in Mexico, and he was having an affair with a married woman. You know, she's probably, I don't know how old she was. I'm guessing maybe 18, 20 years old, whatever. So he goes, yeah, pues ahí andaba, pues haciendo mi cosa, and blah blah blah. And I guess he was at her house when the husband came home. And it's that whole story about jumping out the window and mm-hmm. running home, running for his life, because this guy was going to kill him. And he was a ladies' man. You know, I could show you some of those pictures. Even in his 80s, he was a very handsome man. And he had a lot of girlfriends. I'm not going to lie to you. And he tells us those stories from Mexico that it's a common thread down there that if you're married, I guess you're allowed to have some mistresses. It, you know, sometimes. I don't know how that works, but I know my cousins still do that, which I don't understand, but that's just the way of life down there. And, I, you know, that's the way he was brought up. And you know, like I said, he had 7 or 8 brothers that probably all did the same thing. But that was probably the worst of the bunch, but getting caught almost.
Was your mom jealous after, did he do this after he got married?
Yeah.
Did your mom ever say anything to
Yes.
her?
Yes, it caused a lot of, as a matter of fact, that's another story from the camp. There was a lady who lived catty corner from us, and her name was Lupe Cisneros, Guadalupe Cisneros, big lady. She had the hots for my dad forever and ever and ever, and she had the hots for my dad. And, you know, I don't know, to this day, I have no idea if he ever, you know, had an affair with her or not, but my mom believes that he did, and she took me and Ramiro, because we were probably, and I remember this again, like it's etched in my mind. She took us across the street, the dirt road, to Esperanza Gaspar's house for her to take care of us. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what's going on? Can you, I'll be right back. And she goes over there, beats the living crap out of this woman, just beats the shit out of her. I mean, literally just laid her out and just scratched her all up and... You know, you touch my husband again or you contact him again, you're going to be in big-ass trouble. So she beat her up, came back, brought us back home, and then she had a friend or a boyfriend, and they used to call him King Kong because he was dark skin, mm-hmm. big dude. Well, for me, he was like a giant.
Yeah.
So he wanted to come and kick my mom's butt, and my mom jumped on his ass too. Okay. And my mom's a little lady. She's 5'4". And like I said, it's probably etched in his mind too, but I remember her just walking us across the street. She goes over there, and she did come back with some scrapes and stuff, but she kicked their butts.
She was no little lady.
She was a strong woman, and unfortunately, she's got Alzheimer's right now. My sister's taking care of her, and she would have some great stories to tell. But poor thing, her mind is just gone. But yeah, it was. She was part of the big picture, and right now, when it's wintertime, one of the things that she always did for me, anyways, is she would always take my clothes before I went to school, and she would put them on top of the stove because it was a gas stove. We didn't have heat. Mm-hmm. So she goes, espérate un momento. She'd heat up my clothes. Oh, póntela. Oh, yeah, this feels good. And I tell that to my sons, and they're like, and they almost cry. They're like, did you really have to? And I said, yes. You know, that's just the way it was. We had no heat. It was, but overall, though, it was. You know, in hindsight, people always say, yeah, I could have had a better life. Yeah, everybody could have a better life, but it's your destiny. That's just the way it was planned out.
Yeah, true. Well, thank you so much again.
I appreciate it. Thank you for calling us over.
Oh, thank you for coming.